Is drummer right? Is it okay to say drummer?
Pounding his pulsing beat into the hearts of all America.
You motherfuckers are slapping all over this joint.
You do your kind of drumming, and I'll do my kind of drumming.
I have no more time. You don't know what I'm up against.
The only things I care about this goddamn life are me and my drums and you.
The official explanation was he choked on vomit.
You suppose maybe I could put the drums in your place and sort of drop in?
Now back to Gene Krupa's syncopated style shortly.
Get up there behind those drums, lean back, close your eyes, get right on the groove there, give it a good steady beat.
I got blisters on my fingers!
I'd hit that.
I'm in Austin, Texas.
Yep.
With Brandon Temple.
Hey, man, we're here.
We're sitting outside. I'm not going to name where, because they ain't helping me. So we're not even going to... No plug.
Yeah,
but you're going to hear stuff.
You would have said it during that beep right there.
Heard a car horn. You're going to hear airplanes. You're going to hear... But this is what it is. We were just discussing. I need a studio.
Right. But, you know, the thing about Brandon,
go ahead. You were saying, no, you don't.
Man. I mean, you know, this is what makes this kind of special, because then you can come to the talent, you know. And there's a lot of flexibility. And I think that's good.
Yeah. It would be nice.
Yeah.
And the listeners would appreciate, I'm sure, a nice, quiet, soundproof studio. But...
Well, maybe I should talk up. Speak up.
You'll be all right.
Yeah, I'll be all right.
So, Brandon Temple, first of all, I just want to throw in... It is now Thursday, and last night, I caught Brandon playing at the Continental Gallery, which is upstairs from the Continental Club. Organ duo... The Brandon and Red Show, right?
Yeah.
Badass.
It's all right. You know, sometimes that thing really takes off like a rocket, and sometimes it's like the new rockets. It's hard because it's only two people, and it really takes a lot of trust, a lot of faith, and it's like a school of fish. You know, you gotta try to follow a flock of birds. You know what I mean? Have you ever tried to follow that?
No.
So playing with one other person, you know, the incomparable Red Young, who's amazing, you know, sometimes he can go in one direction and you have to really keenly just become an amorphous energy, you know, and you can't really try to force your things on it sometimes, you know, so it becomes... new every performance, you know. It's not like I can say, okay, I'm gonna do this thing and then that's gonna happen, or I'm gonna play this groove and that's gonna happen. We're playing a cover song, or I'm gonna play the groove from that song. None of that will work, you know. I always have to be sort of malleable for whatever's gonna happen in the moment, and that's no slight to his musicianship or his mastery or my musicianship or my whatever, but when it's only two people, you're covering a larger spectrum than just what you might hear in the context of a record, you know. If we're playing like some R&B classic, you know, for instance, and there's that bass thing that happens here at the same time that this other thing happens, well, it's not always going to all happen at the same time. So we're sort of interpreting as a two-piece. And so sometimes it's incredible. You know, and at other times it's like running out of a burning building. Get out of there! Hurry up! Get out of there! You know, but yeah. Anyway, it's awesome.
It worked last night, man. Yeah. You were flying.
Oh, brother, thank you, man. We've been doing that now, not quite 20 years, but coming up.
What?
Yeah, I think. That band started. We did a record together in Los Angeles with this artist named Stephen Bruton, who really gave me a lot.
Oh yeah, Stephen Bruton. You've did a lot of records with Stephen Bruton.
Well, yeah, just a lot of history there with the dearly departed brother, mentor of mine, you know. But we did one of his records, and Red played on that, and we did a gig somewhere out in like Culver City. I don't know where the gig. It was like really far. And he brought the B3. I was like, you brought that thing? He's like, yeah. I was like, do you live close? Like, I had no concept of a person, a human, doing this by himself. There was no team. He didn't have his boy with him, his crew, you know. It was him, some dollies, and a ramp, like a wheelchair ramp out of his van.
Okay, we got to back up. Is he an Austin guy?
Fort Worth. Okay. He's born in Fort Worth, been living in Austin, and I forgot what year he moved here, but the week he moved here, I got him a gig.
But hold on, just to be clear, was he at that, when you met him on this gig, the Bruton gig, you're saying?
Yeah.
Was he living in L.A.?
Yeah.
Okay.
At that time.
So he's hauling his B3 to the gig.
Yeah, in L.A.
And he's got a whole system.
Who
the
hell does that in L.A. or anywhere?
Okay,
so
does it.
So he
had a whole system, the ramp and the...
Yeah, you know, we're talking the B3, you know, full wooden.
Yeah, what is that?
Furniture.
Do we know the weight on that? Is there a number?
It's about 600. Six something. And then there's the Leslie, you know. And if you have any sort of modified power amps or anything like that, that's going to add weight. Or if you have any sort of cases or anything. Another organist that I work with, Bobby Sparks, like, he'll bring his... he'll bring his organ, and sometimes it's a chopped B3, and it's in a case. That thing is death. It weighs so much. You know, just trying to maneuver that thing. And Bobby doesn't have a ramp. So we're just lifting that thing in and out of the van, and, you know, he's not as savvy as Red when it comes to that. But they're both master musicians on that instrument. But anyway, so he moved to Austin, you know, and like I said, I think that week I got us on a gig, and we've been playing either trio, quartet, or duo since then. You know, we did some stuff with Adam Levy, who's a guitarist. Played with Norah Jones. That's how we met. Right before they went out. Got some little kids over here drinking booze. It's funny.
See, once the girl shows up.
I know.
That's when they gotta flex.
Little high school chicks. They probably, my son goes to the same high school. I'm sure it's right up the street. So, yeah, you know, we've been doing this thing. Adam Levy, you know, we went on the road with him. It was us and Charlie Hunter. And we did some double bill stuff. And that was several years ago. And we were on our way back. And it was a drive from Flagstaff, Arizona to Austin. And I was like, dude, we got to have a gig somewhere between there. And so we found some spot. No, it was L.A. to Austin. We played in Flagstaff.
Okay.
Some hotel, did a gig, and that was the beginning of the duo show. Just on a whim, on a drive back.
Yeah, that was a one-off, and you just...
Yeah, and so I was like, let's do that. And I think it really took him a while to realize that that was a viable thing. Because, like most people, you think, like, it just can't be two people on stage. Unless I'm an acoustic guitarist with a... somebody playing a djembe or something, you know.
Yeah.
But I feel like I convinced him to do this, and then we did it, and we've been doing it ever since.
Nice. He was skeptical. I get it. That's, but 20 years. So, and we were talking last night about that with Red, because in the Continental it was the Flanagan Frosty thing, right, for a while. Did you guys sort of take over from that?
Not really. I mean.
Or
you
was
know,
it two separate things?
Completely.
So there was there a time where that was they were both happening simultaneously?
No, not duo, no.
Okay.
No. You know, for a while we played there with this trumpet player named Ephraim Owens. We did a trio thing. And so that was actually maybe the first gig I got Red was with Ephraim. And I don't think Ephraim could wrap his head around hands and feet playing the bass at first. He was like, well, who do we get on bass? No. Red's going to play bass. Okay, well, who's going to play piano? No, it's not a piano, it's an organ. It's like,
he didn't understand?
It eludes people for some reason.
Shocks me, though, because no. Ephraim Owens is Ephraim Owens.
I mean, like, and this is no slight to the hipness of my brother, but, you know, he just... he was so ingrained in doing quartets with, you know, four
has to
piece
be upright
band.
Bass and has to
exactly.
Be-
these sort of stipulations behind, you know, this is how I create music. And so when you come out from a different box, it's like, wow, what? You know, and we made it work, and we did it for as long as that could last. And then I was already wanting to do the duo thing. That I feel like there's way more freedom in that duo setting.
Yeah.
You know, again, it could be heavenly, you know. And I've done duo and organ settings with, again, with Bobby Sparks, another brother of mine, James Simpson, who lives over in Europe. He's in Germany. I've done it with James Polk is originally from Corpus. You know, he played with Ray Charles for 9 years in the 80s, 70s, 70s and 80s. And, you know, Polk was a B3 legend, the master himself, you know. Intimidated Jimmy Smith. That's a whole other story.
Yeah. Now, just real, you are an Austin guy. You're from
born
Austin.
Born in Austin, yeah.
Yeah, born and raised. Rare.
That's what they say.
I mean, yeah, we know. We can count the musicians who are from here. I mean, it happens. It does.
Yeah, I actually meet musicians that are from here. They're much younger, you know.
Right.
And I go, oh, yeah, where are you from? I'm from here. Oh. And I ask them what high school they went to, and it's one of the newer, newfangled pop-ups that I didn't grow up with when I was a kid, you know. So it's like, oh, okay, that makes sense. Generational difference.
Right.
But, yeah.
But you... I mean, last night, I mean, I'm hearing all kinds of guys, but it's you. But like, I'm hearing Elvin, I'm hearing Blakey, I'm hearing Tony.
Yeah.
And there, I don't know if people think of Austin as a jazz town, you know. So what I want to know is, was this something that was there early for you, or did this come?
My first records that were purchased for me, you know, my dad, when I showed an interest in music, you know, the first thing he did was he brought me two records. The first was a Lionel Hampton live record, and it was on some label, you know, like the jazz guys used to be on these independent labels back in the 70s and 80s and 60s, 70s, 80s and different things like that. And so I couldn't tell you what label it was on or anything. It was just Lionel Hampton Live. That was it, you know. And so Frankie Dunlop was the drummer for that. And so I was really like, whoa, this guy is incredible. And the other record was Max Roach, was it Basin Street? So those are the first two records that my dad introduced me to. Drumming wise, like he didn't start with anything else, you know. So initially, if you start at Max Roach, you know what I'm saying? So,
you
know,
that's,
yeah, I mean, well, that's where you start, you know. And so I guess I'm of the generation that, you know, I was able to early embrace, you know, those masters in that way. That one of the important things to remember, one of the most important things that happened for me was actually the Wynton Marsalis generation, you know, because yes. when and not just with jazz, but with music in general, because for me, I could see young brothers, and they weren't, you know, they were older than me. They would be considered, you know, the Wyntons and the Terrence Blanchard, Donald Harrison, you know, Branford Marsalis, like those guys are like my cousin's ages. So they're like big brothers to me. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like I'm the only son from my dad. They grew up in the house together. So the older influence was like from cousins 5 years older, 6 years older, 7 years old. So Wynton and Branford, those guys are like maybe 6, 7 years older than me, right? So I'm looking at myself when I see Jeff Watts playing.
You're talking, are we going back even to like the Tonight Show?
No. This is way, so we're talking like in the mid 80s. It was a resurgence. Art Blakey was still
Oh, right.
Was still alive.
When Whitney was with Blakey.
Exactly. So we're talking about the Art Blakey of the 80s, the early 80s, where he had, you know, of course, Wynton Marsalis and Branford Marsalis and Billy Pierce.
I just wasn't sure if you meant watching on TV, like seeing
Charles Fambrough. No. Those guys, the later Tane on... And I call him Tane like I know him, which I don't. But
you never met him?
We have met. He saw me play a show once, and I talked to him afterwards, and I was like, kind of like, why are you here? And he's like, I came to check you out, you know. And that kind of blew my mind at that point in my life. I was maybe in my late 20s, early 30s, I don't know. I've been playing long enough to understand that you can learn from anyone, you know. And so why shouldn't that happen the other way around? Why shouldn't someone come to you who is who I consider a great, and they come and they watch your show and they take something from that with them, something that they might not have thought of, or just musical inspiration. So if you are a student of the craft, you know, you're going to pull from any and everything. And so that taught me a big lesson. So anyway, Jeff Watts has always been there for me in terms of one of my influences.
Yeah, now I hear it. I get it.
Okay,
now.
So
that makes sense.
Ralph Peterson Jr., who just passed away last year.
Yeah.
Was a huge influence. And all these guys were under the tutelage and the schooling of Art Blakey.
Like I said.
Directly.
Blakey.
You know, and as well as, you know, they were all, I don't know if Tony Williams ever took students on, but of course, you know, it's hard to touch the drums in any genre and not be indirectly or directly influenced by Tony Williams, period. Because Tony changed drumming more than once. Not as many times as Miles changed music, but Tony Williams changed drumming. When he came out as a 16-year-old after Jackie McLean playing with Miles Davis, those types of polyrhythms were not being played in that way. The type of energy that he was coming with, there were no kids that were doing that. The only other kid that was that age was Lenny White. But Lenny didn't become popular or even known until a few years later. So Tony, and then, you know, all through the 60s with the Miles Davis Quintet, and then he started fusion single-handedly, not Bitches Brew, Tony Williams with Tony Williams Lifetime with John McLaughlin and Larry Young on organ, the organ thing, see?
See, back to that.
Right. And so Tony Williams was, and so then he went from there. And then, of course, he did his sort of rock records and those sorts of things. And then once he got into the VSOP stages in the 70s and 80s, and he was doing writing for his own bands, which are great records, Tony Williams Quintet records, just phenomenal. His drumming changed again, you know. He is the most pivotal drummer, dare I say, musician, one of the tops.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, your action on that ride, like I said, it was like, shit.
Whew, boy.
I'm
trying to work it out.
Time.
I need to be practicing now. I need to be out here talking. Now, I'm going to tell you that much. I heard something from Ray Charles once, although I didn't meet him. This is a quote that I heard, of course. But he was like, you know, no matter what I do or the heights that I reach, I will never be able to exhaust the piano. Like, no matter what I do, when I walk away, the piano will be looking at me like, is that all you got?
Yeah. No, you're never finished. We're never finished.
Never. So, like, you know, you can destroy a ride cymbal, but that doesn't mean that you've accomplished anything. Necessarily, you know. It doesn't mean that you burn it to the ground. I mean, you know, it could just simply be bad technique, or sometimes be surprised that a lot of cymbals crack around the eyelid, you know. And so that structural damage structural damage can occur. And a lot of these hand-hammered cymbals now sometimes can be a little uneven and unbalanced, very imperceptible to the eye. But if you sit them on a cymbal stand, they'll go in the same place every time, every time, every time, because that's what the weight is not distributed equally, right? So if you're playing on a cymbal over and over again, well, it's going to have a breaking point. It's possible. It's plausible. So even if you overpower that cymbal, it doesn't mean you're running things. You know what I'm saying? It's just meant that. So trust me, I need to be practicing like right now as we speak. This is no joke. I'm not.
By the way, I want to actually, let's take a second on that, because do you have a spot? Are you?
I do. Yeah. I mean, okay. Right now I'm at, you know, just in the crib, in the garage.
Okay, but you have it. Okay, okay. Yeah. I got you. All right. Yeah. But you're putting in every day. You're going in.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
Yeah, okay, okay. Yeah. Hey, of course. All right. Yeah. Right, thank you. Because if you had said, nah, you know, I hate, like, those guys are so annoying. Because I know a few guys, I won't name them today, but sure. They've admitted it on the show.
Yeah.
And there's, you know, cats that, you know, you know are badasses. We all know. And they're like, yeah, I really should be doing it more. And you're thinking,
But here's the thing, you know, everybody has different aspirations and they have different abilities and different intentions.
Sure.
You know, and I can't judge any other person's journey or mine or for theirs. You know, I really think it's important to value whatever it is that you have, like what you're trying to do, trying to say, trying to bring, you know. So, yeah, there are definitely people who don't need, and I put that in air quotes, to spend the time. And you can hear them and think, wow, yeah, this person's got it, you know. And sometimes people have figured out, maybe through trial and error or just through an innate feeling or being, how to do what they do. And that's just, it is what it is. Whether they do it or don't do it, that's what it is.
Yeah.
You know. Yeah. And so I think the majority of us are not like that. You know, if you listen to Herbie Hancock, you know, Herbie's like, you know, he's talking about shedding, practicing. You know, he didn't, you know, of course, it's known that he was a child prodigy in classical music. But he had to transition to jazz, you know, throughout his teens. And, of course, playing with Miles in his 20s. So, that's a lifelong journey. He didn't wake up like that, you know. So, yeah, I definitely didn't wake up like that. I need to be practicing right now.
So, jazz, though, for you, we're going back to that. You were young, and it started young.
Yeah. 10.
Yeah, which is wild. I mean, you know what I mean. It's not that common.
No.
To be 10 and, like, appreciating jazz. I mean, that in itself is a very rare thing.
It's, yeah, I don't know if that's good or bad. Bananas.
It's odd.
Yeah.
It's a little odd. I mean, I don't know what it was like for you growing up. I mean, did you also then go through your, I don't know, your rock and roll phase, your...
Yeah, all of that. I mean, you know, before there was jazz or before there was drumming, you know, there was James Brown, you know, and then there was, you know, the music of, you know, anything in the 70s, like some of the records that sort of turned me out. I remember my sister used to go to University of North Texas, you know, in Denton. And so we would drive her up, you know, back and forth, you know, for whatever, holidays, you know, bring her home, but whatever. And, you know, in Austin in the 70s, if you want to paint the picture of AM radio, you know, there was not really a lot of stations that would be urban, if you will, you know. And
what are we getting, all country?
No. I mean, it was pop radio. You know, definitely pop radio, rock, light rock.
But did Days to Confuse capture it? I mean,
yeah, somewhat. You know, I mean, and the same thing with, you know, one of my buddies that I grew up with, man, his dad used to listen to country. So that always was a trip, like a brother listening to country. And we'd be riding around going to karate. We used to take karate and shit. So we'd go. And so I knew country music. You know, I had all this stuff that was just coming in. But in 1970,
1977. We were in Denton, and now you're getting radio stations from a larger market. You're getting radio from Dallas. So my dad would go to, you know, those areas, so he knew what the stations were. So he put on, like, the black station. And I was hearing stuff that I'd never heard before, because I only heard his 8-tracks or his albums or his 45s. I never heard anything outside of my dad's collection. But now we're hearing current tunes on the radio, and lo and behold, I'm in the backseat of the Oldsmobile, right? And dun 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 dun. So One Nation Under Groove comes on from Funkadelic. But that was a Parliament record. And it blew my mind. That tune, I was just like, what is this? It was so much going on, like the way that they were singing. It was like choral, but it was also gospel. And then there was like African, because there were these bells and stuff, you know, going on. And it was like a driving beat. I never heard anything like that before. I was like, what is this? You know? And so different things like that would happen and just sort of give me early DNA, you know. So this was well before jazz, you know. Being a kid in the 70s, you know, I loved the Jackson 5. Michael Jackson was it, you know. So to grow up seeing those afros and seeing the dancing and I think this generation of iteration of humanity, popular, at least from the way I see it on my Instagram feed, I think, and of course that's biorhythmic or whatever, it's got its little algorithmic bullshit, but you have to understand that culturally, dating back to the 1920s, the dancer was the star of the show. 1920s, if you look at any bill from Cotton Club or any of the clubs uptown in Harlem and all that kind of stuff, the singer was a feature, but the big band, the band, was the feature. Even in bigger name, bigger lights on the marquee, was the dancer. That's our heritage. That's black heritage. So the dancer was up top. So when you start and you look at a James Brown, you watch James dance, he is the rhythm. James Brown is the drummer. Everything happens and pivots off of what he's doing. So all of the beats that we, you know, dissect, you know, the Jabbo Starks, the Class Doublefields, the Melvin Parkers, the whatevers, none of that shit would be shit without James Brown. Nothing. It doesn't matter. JB is the beginning. So take that to Michael Jackson, who JB was his biggest influence, entertainment wise, dancing. You know, of course, Jackie Wilson was great, all those other guys, but JB was at the top. So Michael, of course, wanted that. And of course, he was known as a great entertainer. I still feel like Michael Jackson was a brilliant entertainer in his dancing. So when I see him dance, his music might not be, it was always that battle between he and Prince. You know, Prince was always like, well, Michael's never funky. It's not funky, right? I'm a huge Prince fan. I'll talk about that too, but whatever. But the point is, Michael, if you see footage of him recording music or expressing himself, he's not doing it without body movement. So all the rhythm is right there in his body. So again, the dancer is the drummer.
Well, this does go back. I mean, you're right. I mean, Sammy Davis. There's a lot of dancing back then. Like, that's how a lot of those guys came up. That was the first training. That doesn't really happen anymore.
Well, that's my point, you know.
Which is, you are making an interesting point, because it made me think of, remember that time, because we're roughly in the same generation.
Sure.
I remember hearing about football players taking ballet. Remember that?
Absolutely.
You don't hear about that anymore.
Yeah, that's just not a thing. These guys now, you know, because that was like Len Swan from Pittsburgh Steelers. Len Swan took ballet. And it was widely known that, you know, he did that because he wanted to sort of explore the agile nature, you know, the jumps. And there's so much dope footage of Len Swan and Super Bowls whooping Dallas Cowboys, like catching these crazy passes, man, overcast heads and leading flipped. Man, Len Swan was the hero. Like, guys like that.
It looked artistic.
He was an artist. Jerry Rice.
Right.
These guys are artists, man.
Why did that get lost, you think? Why? Why did the dancing thing?
Because at a certain point, in the 90s, that was the end. You know, the late 80s in hip-hop.
Because wasn't Tupac a dancer?
He was a hype dancer in the digital underground.
Okay, yeah. Okay, so he was also a trained dancer, though, right?
I don't know that.
Okay.
I personally don't know that. But possibly. I mean, he definitely was super creative.
But you're right. You're hitting on something. Like, you don't see this anymore with, like, the up and coming. Like, that's not in the background.
No.
Ladies, yes.
No. Culturally, there's
ladies
definitely...
ladies love to dance. We have to just establish, like, they do.
But culturally, like...
But men.
And, like, historically black colleges, right?
Mm-hmm.
Universities. You still see step shows, you know, from the frats, you know, the Omegas and the Alphas and, you know, and the stuff like that. So the younger generation, it's connected, but it's with the pulse of today. It's with the dance of, you know, whatever hip hop sounds like now, whatever R&B sounds like now. Those are the dances. Those are the things that are connected. So it's there. Again, my feed might be old. I might be too old, you know, but it exists, but not at the level of even in the 2000s with Usher and Chris Brown. You know, like Chris Brown or not, that's a bad dude. He can dance his ass off now to this day. You know, and same thing with Usher. These guys were they understood the Michael Jackson, the James Brown,
yeah,
the Sammy Davis, like these things like that.
Did you ever take dancing lessons growing up? Did you?
No, I did not. You know, I didn't.
That didn't really, you didn't like connect those dots, you think, at that point? You just weren't thinking like that?
I absolutely did.
You did?
But I did not, I didn't go down that road, like, for myself personally, to do dance, you know. I knew that once the drums chose me, I figured, like, okay, that's where it's at.
Yeah.
You know, and it's a blessing and a curse in a way, you know, because we all know that in 2022, you sort of have to always have multiple hats, you know.
Well,
so diversifying.
Yeah,
you know,
this is a newer.
Yeah, this is a newer thing. So it you can't just be the drummer anymore.
Well, so what does that mean for you now?
That's a great question. What does that mean for me now? So that, you know, there has to be songwriting, there has to be production, there has to be marketing, there has to be merchandising, there has to be, you know, anything that is still my lane enough in my head, I guess. But even that's debatable, you know, because if I was one of these guys who felt like I didn't have to practice, and every time I sat down, the same shit came out of me, like, and it was good, it's viable, maybe I'm into real estate. I mean, I don't know, you know what I mean? So it just really depends. There's really no more blueprint for anything, you know? And it's for guys our age, you know, it's a challenge. You know, for younger cats, they grew up with it. You know, it's like growing up, and like in the 70s, I used to think, wow, it'd be interesting if we ever had a black president, and it probably never happened. You know, and then my kids are born, and that's the only president, that's the first president they knew. You know, so right. That's a line that they never had to consider. Never had to think about it. It was never a thought. So going back to drumming and going back to what does a musician do, well, the sky's the limit. You know, we have to sort of align ourselves with the youth, if you will, like the younger 18-year-olds, right, that are seem to be a little more free. They might be a little less pinpointed, some of them.
But looks scattered, you saying?
Sometimes.
Yeah.
But, you know,
it's back to, like you said, diversifying. They're more trained to be just sort of octopus-like.
So yeah, you know, I think that
have their,
there's no limits. My 11-year-old daughter, I see her brain is like limitless. You know?
Right. Yeah, like you feel like when you look back at your own childhood, there seemed to be a lower ceiling. Is that what you're saying, to some degree?
No, societally. Not in my head, necessarily.
But you still felt like I can only do so much.
Well, but what I wanted to do, I thought was great. Like when I was, let's see, what year was that? 1980, 1979, the Jacksons put out Destiny, and then Michael Jackson put out Off the Wall. That was all like in a 2-year period, right around at that same time.
When was The Wiz?
78.
Damn,
79.
I know this shit.
Something like
it.
That. Okay, so.
Okay, so that's, I get the order. Okay.
Right, so The Wiz was Quincy Jones.
Yes.
So Michael met Quincy during
The Wiz.
During
yeah.
The Wiz, okay,
yeah,
so.
Yeah.
Quincy's in the movie. Quincy did the soundtrack, you know. And so it's funny. Somebody asked Quincy, what did you have to change to work with Michael? He said, I didn't have to change shit. Michael wanted to work with me. So if you go back to records that Quincy did during that time, The Dude and all of James Ingram, the early stuff, that's what Off the Wall sounds like. It's all the same music. You know, just he was just hiring songwriters and just plugging in his ideas and his cats to implement his vision. And Michael was just part of the vision. He was already producing. You know, if you go through the history of Quincy Jones's records, he's never the star. Mm-hmm. Quincy Jones has always been the sideline guy. But he's the name at the top. He's a cultivator of talent. He's a cultivator of magic in a way.
He really set the tone.
He sets the tone.
That vision of the producer who just sort of creates the vibe.
Yep.
Safe to work in.
Yeah, man, what an ingenious. You have to have a lot of imagination, a lot of love. You just have to be just bananas in your brain to think that you can pull certain things off. I'm listening to like this a book of the audio book with Will Smith, you know, and he's talking about his meeting with Quincy Jones and how Will had to audition for Quincy. Basically, he flew in from a recording session, landed, went to Quincy's house. Benny Medina brought him there.
Of course.
Met him in the driveway. He walks in. Oh, hey, great, you're here. All right, clear the room. And so as soon as he walks in, Quincy sets up an audition for him. And
all the proper players are in the room at the same time. It's Quincy's birthday. So there's the head of NBC, there's the lawyer of the head of NBC, there's the underwriter for the, all the people are in the room, in the same room. Oprah's there, like everybody is in the room.
Is this pre-Fresh Prince?
Oh, I'll get there. Okay.
Okay.
So he goes in the room and he's like, okay, we're going to do an audition. Will's like, great. Who's auditioning? And he's like, no, you're the guy. You're auditioning. He's like, remember Benny asked you about, if you did any acting? And you said, yeah. Okay, so here we go. And so he goes, Quincy, I can't do this. I need a minute. I'm like, okay, well, what do you need? 10 minutes? You need a whiskey? What do you need? And the whole time, Quincy is just like bubbling with excitement. Will is scared. He's about to shit on himself. And he goes, man, I need a week. Quincy goes, you need a week? Yeah, week. It's a week. It'd be great. Yeah, I could take the script. Get somebody to help me out read it. I could do some acting class real quick. Okay, so we do. We take a week. Okay, that's cool. That's great. But wait, this guy is gonna realize he's got an appointment and he can't get out of it. So we got to do 2 weeks. 2 weeks would be better, Will says, right? And so Quincy's like, 2 weeks, great. Okay, so at that 2 week period, this guy is gonna realize he's got his daughter's recital and his wife is gonna tear him a new one if he tries to get out of that. So it's probably gonna be a month. A month is better. And he's realizing, son, you're not getting it. Like, we're here. Everything we need is in the moment. So to me, that resonates in a large way, being a musical improviser. Because you can say, damn, if I just practice a little more. There is a point where preparation meets opportunity. This is a catchphrase of...
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Great one.
And it's brilliant.
It is.
But you still have to show up and just give it and do it, you know, especially if you're playing like an improvised set of music. Again, things can go any kind of way at any point.
Yes. That's very true.
It's really important just to be in the moment, right? So when you... And to not have too many chains or rigors that you're trying to put straight onto things, because you might have to change it at a split second. You know, a dynamic change, playing loud to soft, omission, you know. That's why I don't see the value in practicing licks. You know, when is that ever viable? I'm a huge Bruce Lee fan, you know, so Bruce Lee with Jeet Kune Do was always under the impression that fixed forms don't work in street fights. Okay, now he's going to come with an overhand right. So now I have to counter, I have to step back, I have to throw this arm up, and then I have to put this arm here, but his arm has to go exactly in that place for me to, you know.
That's not real life.
It's not a real fight. You know, real fights, almost all real fights end up on the floor. You know what I'm saying? So unless you're studying that, you know.
Yeah, MMA, exactly. Like, that's more realistic.
Yeah, it's just more realistic, right?
Yeah.
But the point is that's in the moment, and then those possibilities can seem endless, you know. That's what you want. You want to have the thought or the knowledge or the being of endless possibilities on the drums in the moment. Same thing with Will Smith. So it's like Quincy Jones really seeing this whole idea of the endless possibility. So he orchestrated. Maybe he didn't know it. Maybe he did. Maybe he did know it's my whatever birthday, 50th, I don't know what birthday party it was. And I think it was like maybe a day before some, like the Grammys. It was something, you know what I mean? Like a lot of people were in town, this whole thing. And so, but he knew, I guess it seems like he lives his life according to what I keep hearing. I've met Quincy like this, like just in passing, but I've never sat down with him and had a conversation or anything like that. So I don't know him by any stretch. But he seems like someone, again, who is interested in possibilities at all times. You know, you got to be if you've been married like 5 times. You know, you know what I mean? You're interested in some possibilities, you know what I mean? Like, this is good now, but over there, it's a possibility, you know what I mean? So
that's a man with options. That's a man with limitless options.
Right, but
when you're Quincy Jones, I mean, it's raining.
But think about Tony Williams. When you hear Tony, do you think Tony is fixed in his mind? He sounds limitless. He sounds limitless. And that, man, what a...
Well, you really do have that thinking. I mean, again, last night we were talking, I was leaving and we were on break, halftime. And we were saying, okay, so trying to set up the time. And I love Brandon because he's got that philosophical edge to him. Like, I can see that. He's just in you at all moments. There it is. The big kahuna. And we talked about time. What time? And Brandon said, well, I mean, what is time? It's great. You know, I love that attitude. I love that way of looking at everything. You're just... question, and you, I get that about you. You're a seeker, you're a searcher, you're a...
Yeah, I think on the drums, you know...
I mean, not again, it applies to your life. I mean,
but let me just say this. Not that I'm all that, right? You know, but the point is that sometimes that works to my... It works to my advantage a lot. But sometimes I'm at a disadvantage because I'm always listening and I'm always thinking. I'm always curious. And I make people that I work with think. And this is not I'm not patting myself on the back.
People don't like that.
I've been fired for that. I've been fired because I make people think.
People do not like that.
They don't like it. I got told once by a guy, handed me a fat ass envelope full of money. Played a New Year's gig with this guy, right? Hands me this envelope. This is before checks. And he says, "Hey man, I think I'm gonna go in a different direction this year." I say, "Oh, okay, cool, no problem." And it really was no big deal. You know, it wasn't my band. It wasn't, you know. And I said, "Well, you care sharing, you know, is there anything in particular?" He's like, "Man, you know, when I'm thinking it, somehow you're already playing it. Like, I don't know how you do it. Like, I've never played with anybody on any instrument that hears music in that way. So I just need dumber drumming because I find myself listening to you." "I need dumber drumming." That's the quote. I hope I never go senile. I hope I remember that shit for my whole entire ass life.
That's the back of your book right there.
Yeah, I got replaced on another situation because a guy was gonna do a TV broadcast, and at the last minute, the drummer that normally played with them became available. But I knew, I've been playing with this guy. I knew the book, you know what I mean? And he says, "Well, I think I'm gonna go with the other guy." And I was like, "Oh yeah? Well, what's up?" "Well, when he plays, I don't have to think. And you sort of make me want to follow you."
Back to that.
Yeah. And I'm like, you guys are giving me a lot of power. And I'm not saying that, I'm not, and here's the thing, I'm not laughing at it. I'm not patting myself on the back, nor am I denying it. It's all true. It is what it is. You know, there might be drummers, a ton of drummers that can do a lot of things way better than me. Way better. You know, for whatever the gig is, you know, they might be more appropriate for the sound here, or the touch here, or the, you know, the thought processes here. But that's one thing that I guess I enjoy about myself, is that searching quality. You know, I don't know how to do anything else. That's just how my head works.
Right, it's applicable to everything in your life. That's what I'm saying. You're just that guy, and you probably bother in relationships and friend people who know you, and they're like, "Man, like it can be," or you get a lot of, "I never thought of it that way."
Yeah, you know.
Right, you hear that a lot in your life.
Yeah, I can.
I never thought of that before. I never thought of that.
It keeps everybody on their toes, and I think sometimes. You know,
you threw some good curves last night. You're talking to the audience. He's like, "I'm a Virgo." You're just like throwing out these random things.
Yeah, sometimes I get bored.
But that's the beauty again. Yeah. It's like, who's expecting this shit? Nobody.
Yeah, but you know, again, but that's also it's gotten me work too. You know,
right?
So I've gotten more work than I've lost with this one particular quality, you know.
Right, right.
So I'm thankful for that, you know. But, you know, here's the thing, man. At the end of the day, it's not meant for me to play with everybody. You know, my philosophy is I'm where I'm supposed to be at all times. You know, that doesn't mean that I don't like money. And you know, could benefit from working in a situation like at that time, or you know what I mean?
Sure,
like,
sure, sure.
But
well, has that come up? Have opportunities come up where you thought, "Oh, this could be big money," and but it meant a move?
What kind of move?
Geographical.
Geographical. Excuse me. No. I'm not having to deal with that, really. But I have made some interesting decisions. Like, before you have kids, you can kind of play around. You know? And so I had all these gigs where I was doing, like, independent bands. This was right at the period, early 2000s, where a lot of people were making their own records, CDs, you know what I'm saying? So like late 90s, early 2000s, record labels were starting to kind of crumble. A lot of independents, but even beyond the independent, bands were putting records out on themselves. And so I was working with several artists at that time, and we were all doing it, so it was like we're all going in the same direction. So I was really, really intrigued by this, really happy about this, because I'd worked with, you know, people in LA and different places where they were ruled by these record companies, and it really was frustrating for me to hear, just to feel, I don't even know what to call it, but it was like there was someone to answer to at all points for everything. And I felt that even if it wasn't a record company situation, that artist was with the record company, but we were in rehearsals, but they still had the mentality of the lack. It was like, it was so structured that it was just not fun. Everything was like work, like very structured work. And so with these artists, again, it was that limitless thing, you know. You're kind of struggling, but you're happy because 100% of what you make is yours.
Yeah.
You know, and excuse me. And so, at that time, I got a call for to do a tour. And it was the first time I booked my band on an international tour. Like my band that I recorded with my money and my, you know, my stuff, my songs and different things like this, or the band songs and different things. And my buddy Earl Harvin calls. He's like, "Hey, Brandon. Hey, man. I'm doing this. I don't want to say who it is." So he's telling me a gig that he's doing.
It's a high level gig.
Yeah. And I knew he was doing the gig, you know. I knew he had the situation on lock and everything. And mind you, we're talking throughout because we're buddies. So it's not like he just called cold. We're talking throughout the rehearsal process. And he's like, "Man, they want me to play electronic drums." I'm like, "What?" He's like, "Yeah, I don't really want to do that." And I was like, "Wow, that's crazy." He said, "Well, at least I'm just going to keep my snare and cymbals." And then he calls back, "Man, they're going to make me take away the snare. It's going to be all pads." I was like, "What?" And he's like, "I don't want to do this, man." And so then he goes and he calls me back like a week later and says, "Hey, man, excuse me." He's like, "Hey, man, I'm going to quit the gig." He's like, you want to do the gig?" But before he said that, he can't forget, like a week before, he's like, "Man, any fucking monkey can do this." And so when he asked me about...
Right. So a week later, "Hey, you want to do the gig?"
And so I'm like, "Bruh, yeah. You realize a week ago you said this."
Right.
And we kind of laughed about it. But, he was just done. He was done. And so... And it was real, you know.
No amount of money is worth this.
Yeah, so guys started calling me the camp call, you know. But it was just the MD. And so, you know, that was going to be the next... I guess the keyboard player had talked to me. The MD was talking to me. And it was like, the next would have been to say yes. And then the accountant. And then there we go. Get some plane tickets and let's roll.
Right.
And I didn't have kids, so I was like, "No, I'm gonna turn it down. I'm gonna go down my road and do this whole thing." Now, I have very few regrets, and it's not that I regret not doing that gig, because it just, here's the thing that I learned about gigs that are not yours: when it's over, nobody cares. Not really. They don't. It's like you go to the next thing. It's a building block.
That's why I was. Yeah.
It's a building block. Yeah. You know, and but you know, there's the exposure piece. There's the building block piece. There's the networking piece. There's a lot of things. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean.
But when you invest in yourself, you know, that's something that brings a different kind of fortification, you know, and that's just where I was at that particular time. Now, mind you, if I had kids, I would have ditched all of my shit and, you know, just done the money gig. And it would have been great. It would have set me up at that particular time in my life. It would have been cool. So every now and again, you know, you're always going to be... I guess every day you can be faced with some kind of decision.
Yeah, you play know. What if, the road, the paths, the crossroads, the whole thing.
So that's the one thing. That's the one time, the one right. gig that I wish that maybe... What would have happened if I put my stuff on the back burner? Mm. But so then I go... I spent the years leading up to that point, and maybe about 3 years after that, really focused on my own bands. And so I'd still have road gigs. I'd go out on the road, or I'd see cats that would come through town, and I'd hang out with my drum buddies or different guys like that. And they'd be like, "Well, man, you still doing your band?" I'm like, "Yeah, let me hear it." So I'd play a little bit of the music. And all of the guys were always a little envious like they wish that they were in that position. And I'm looking at them going, you can't be. You know, it's just a decision. That's all it is. It's a choice. You know. Every now and again, I look at them and go, yeah, I wish I was in your shoes. Because my shit is hard. It's hard labor. Like, if I don't push, then nothing happens. If I don't lift, nothing moves. If I don't shove, you know what I mean? So now, that puts me into the headspace of the now. I've been doing this. Being an independent musician where I do get calls, do get hired, I do go out on tours, and I do different things. But I've always had the mentality of having to do for self. You know? So nothing's really changed.
Right. Right, and it's also, again, I mean, I'm not sure if you're, I don't know, maybe you are aware of the idea of sort of being from Austin, Texas, sort of outside, like you said, the LA, New York thing, the Nashville thing. And that's just also a part, it's like that, it's just part of the culture.
Yeah.
It was always there.
Yeah, Austin has always been like a thing, you know, where people just kind of make it happen for themselves here.
That's what I'm saying. Like, it's just part of where you literally came from.
Yeah.
But back to that for a moment. Were there times, like, I know I spoke to JJ, for example, and he was, you know, into the jazz thing.
Yeah, of course.
Texas guy. I guess not technically an Austin guy, if you're not from Texas. But, I mean, sorry, not from Austin.
Yeah.
Sorry. But that idea of, you know, maybe New York, because let's face it, Mecca for jazz, absolutely.
Yeah.
So
it's not like I didn't live there. I did.
I was gonna say. So let's just talk about that for a moment. I mean, that trajectory of you went through that. I've got to go to New York to be a jazz guy.
Oh man, it's a burning what if, because you'll always feel like you need to be, like, measured against those that are doing it, that are actively in that scene. And there's always this question. I'm not saying me. I'm saying cats, you know. Am I on the level? You know what I mean? And so if you're not there, that's something that you're always thinking. Am I on the level? And I know I'm not the only person that's saying this. I'm grown now. I know people, you know. And I'm in a position now where I'm the old motherfucker in the band. So I'm like mentoring kids, you know, cats. And so they're telling me this same very thing, you know. I should try my hand in New York. But yeah, if that's what's calling you, the sky's the limit. You'll find whatever it is you're looking for. And I never say there. Yeah, you'll find what you're looking for. I went to New York, and, you know, no doubt, I saw, I moved to New York September 10th, 2001.
No, you didn't. Holy shit.
Yep.
Wait. Let's set it up.
See, here's the thing, though. See, my dad's from Georgia, but he grew up in the Bronx, right? So I've always had New York ties.
Do you know where in the Bronx?
Even to this day. Well, my grandparents, they were off of Katrona Parkway. Now, they've gone. And most of my family's no longer in the city. I have two cousins that are still in the city.
So wait, how old was your dad when he moved down to New York?
When he left New York?
Yeah.
18.
So did he still have that New Yorker in him? Like, did he still?
Always.
Like the intonation, the
he that was never his because
he didn't sound like a New Yorker.
Not to me.
But was there an attitude that
absolutely
seems, yeah
he was a ball player, you know, and so like when you have to put yourself in this idea, like in the 50s, there's no TV, right? There's no you know, so your news about different things is from a newspaper.
It's radio.
From the radio, yeah. That sort of thing. And so my dad came to Texas on a sports scholarship. And basically, he met Jackie Robinson.
Wait, he was a baseball player?
It was sports. My dad did it.
Oh, he was one of those guys.
Yeah.
He could do it all.
Yeah. And so he met Jackie, and a fellow who owned it was a namesake clothing store on 125th Street called Jackie Robinson's. Jackie was at the store, and the owner of the store's nephew was playing baseball with my dad. Jewish kid. He told me his name. I can't remember it right now. And my uncle owns this shop. It's Jackie Robinson's. Oh, your uncle owns that shop? He's like, yeah. I've been telling him about you. So they go and meet him, and the guy's like, oh, hey, yeah. I know a guy in Texas. There's a college down there that's just opening up. It's in Texas. Austin, Texas. It's called, there's two colleges are merging. It's Sam Houston and Tillotson College. They're going to merge it. So Houston-Tillotson is like a few miles that way, East Austin, right? But my dad came down, the second year they were open, on a sports scholarship. And Jackie was at the store and actually told him, yeah, you know, that I think that's probably a good opportunity for a colored kid. And, you know, as a...
Who better to hear that from,
yeah.
By the way? I mean, come on.
And so...
Who's higher than that?
And so Jackie Robinson was the top.
I was going to say, at that time, too, I happen to know that was also... Sugar Ray Robinson would have been in the Bronx, too.
Yeah.
By the way.
Yeah. Absolutely. Sugar Ray...
My mother is from there. That's why I know that. She grew up in that neighborhood.
What part?
Where Sugar Ray lives.
Oh, wow.
I mean, this is, of course, when he's a star.
Yeah. Well, I mean, actually, Sugar Ray owned clubs and...
Yes.
Like a couple of, like, little... more than one business.
But she... I mean, my mother always
legitimate
said, like,
businesses.
He was like that guy, like, who was always, like, really great to, like, giving back to the neighborhood.
Absolutely.
Like he was that guy.
Absolutely. He was that
he
guy.
He was the Pope. He could walk down and just... Because he just gave so much,
yep,
to the...
So yeah. You know, Sugar Ray, Jackie.
Right. Who was bigger? I don't. No,
yeah, because you're athletics. That's it.
That's it. At that time,
they were beloved.
At that time,
universally beloved. You know, and still are to this day. So anyway, so Jackie tells him to come down. He takes a one-way ticket, a bus, Texas, Austin, Texas, and. Sees my mother like the first week he gets there. The most beautiful chick on the campus. He sees her. Oh wow! But
and where's she from?
My mother's born in Austin.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But New York, there's just there's this urgency, and just life moves a little quicker and mentally, you know, and just energetically, right? So he came down and. He'd be playing basketball, and he was doing moves that nobody had really seen, you know. And he kind of played, you know, he might play a little dirty, you know. You're under the hoop waiting for the lay, waiting for the rebound, and you step on the other dude's foot and grab the ball. And cats are like, what, huh? Look down, or, you know, he taught me a few little tricks that, you know, they don't fly now.
Yeah.
In ball.
Right.
But refs weren't really hip to him.
Right.
You know.
Well, they don't do brushback pitches anymore. They don't do, like, you're not allowed to do
Well,
this.
Yeah. There's just a lot of plays that are...
Just, we don't do that anymore.
We don't do those things anymore.
We don't do those things.
And so...
Yeah.
But my dad thrived when he came down in basketball. And since was in a league. It was recognized later by the... Sort of like the black leagues, they have like a banquet and different things like that. The PVIL is pretty cool. Well, anyway, but he brought that whole different kind of mentality
to himself.
You know? Yeah, I was gonna say you get it then. You really do get the whole New Yorker thing.
Yeah. You know, so being there, I realized I didn't have to be there. You know,
it was in you.
Yeah. I liked the way I felt there. And on any given night, you could see whoever, you know, throw down at a club, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And sometimes it really wasn't that much money, you know?
Yeah.
Or, you know, I used to do this one jam session. Dude, what was his name? It's a bass player. He was on that Ahmad Jamal record with Herlin Riley playing drums. It's like a live record. And Herlin's playing drums and this bass player. Anyway, I played a jam session with this guy. And he was like, hey, man, are you in town next week? And I was coming back to Austin. And he's like, so I had a gig for you. And so things, you know, things could happen like really quickly.
So you weren't there long.
I was there
for
a year.
You got there September 10th. I mean, that itself is like a whole podcast.
Yeah.
That story.
I had too much going on in Austin. You know, too many artists that I was still connected to. And I wasn't quite ready to give up. Steven was one of them. Bruton was one of them. And
probably had a better life here.
Yeah, everything was a hustle there. I used to have this. Yeah. I had this one. I had these two jam sessions. So the one with that guy had... It was it paid $30, and it was from eight to 11, and I had to bring drums, and so to put my drums in a cab was $27.
There you go.
You know, coming and going.
Clearing $3.
Yep. Yeah, and then I had this other jam session that started at 1 a.m. They had drums, but it paid $10. You know, and then when it's over, you can't really get a cab at like 4. And you can't get a train at 4. So you just roaming the streets or, you know.
Until 6 or something.
Yeah, whenever the train start moving around, right? And so I was like, dude, this is rough. You know, and so I had some decent gigs. Used to play at 55 Bar and a couple other little private things and out of town. And, you know, I had some stuff going on, but a lot of sit-in situations and a lot of prospects. And it could have built, but I just was, I wanted to explore what was going on and apply that to what I was already doing. You know what I mean? At home, like with the cats I was working with at home. I really used it as more of an exercise. Like I never really wanted to live there forever.
I got you.
You know?
I get it. I mean, I think it's cool too. I mean, people don't realize, like Freddie Hubbard is from Austin.
Freddie Hubbard's for what?
Not Freddie Hubbard. Kenny Dorham is from Austin, Texas.
Well, he wasn't born in Austin.
He wasn't?
No.
He was raised?
He came down for a period of time, and he was in Austin. So, he's not in Longview, but he's up there. He was born up by Corsicana, Mejia. It's before you get... It's past Waco.
Oh, okay.
Well before Dallas.
So he came down to Austin later?
Yeah.
Okay.
And so, yeah. But anyway, yeah, he had ties in Austin. Definitive ties in Austin. But he wasn't born here.
But you had a jazz scene here.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You know, there were some things that were frustrating about it. You know, but I hear that in cats in New York. There's a lot of cats that aren't necessarily swinging up there. Maybe now, young guys are going back to it. A lot of people left.
Yeah.
A lot of cats ended up in L.A.
Yeah.
Or just back home.
A lot of guys in L.A. left to Nashville.
Yeah. Everybody's looking for that, the greener grass. Yeah. You know, the cats in New York are like, it'll be nice to have a house. It'd be nice to make some money. It'd be nice to, like, not have to hustle and shuffle for everything. That was the one thing about New York. Man, I loved it, but, like, it's a grind.
It is.
Everything, every day. Every day. there's no rest.
No.
You know. And not that you need rest, but rest is nice sometimes. You know, every now and again. And I'm not really a cold person either, like cold temperature person.
Yeah.
But
we agree on that.
Alright. But again, you know, the lessons that I learned, the types of drummers that I was able to see, the types of musicians, the types of brains and hearts that I was able to see in a short amount of time, it's impossible to see that anywhere else.
Yeah. Did you keep up with the, because you've mentioned a couple times martial arts, did you keep up with that?
A love interest.
Are you a boxing fan?
Yeah.
Yeah. What else are you into? Like, what else do you, when you want to step away from the music? Do you have other interests?
Yeah, my kids, you know, and their well-being and their, you know, interests. And, you know, that's kind of at the top of the list. I really dig... Here's the thing. I'm not really up on a lot of current athletes, current sports. And so I can't chop it up with you right now on that.
No.
I have, like, a group of heroes that I check in on all the time, that I go back and see their heyday moments. You know, Mike Tyson, you know, Muhammad Ali, Magic Johnson. You know, like these types. You know, I really go back and I just watch their interplay. You know, and sometimes, you know, you'll see documentary style pieces. Excuse me, and there's narration. I'll do that. I'll watch that. But sometimes I like to see unnarrated things and just take in what I'm taking in, you know, and see the universal nature of how they take that preparation and that skill and play in the moment or fight in the moment or box, you know, do that thing in the moment. And, the level of intellect, or the level of humanity, or the level of stamina, or the level of ingenuity, you know, all these things that are relevant to just all of our lives. I think that's why we love, you know, that's why everybody loved Rocky back in the day, because you could relate to, you know, the underdog thing and the triumph of the fight, you know, I think that what is it, like, the way of that storyline where you have a person that's got to go through something challenging, it's all love stories. It doesn't matter what
it is. The hero's journey,
the love story thing,
impossible, right? That the love story, the impossibility, Apollo Creed, like, how could that's not possible?
There's no way you can feel. And of course, the first Rocky, he loses.
Yeah,
which is
actually a great ending.
It's brilliant.
Which is actually believable.
Yeah, and sets it up for Rocky II.
He shouldn't be able to beat Apollo Creed.
No,
it wouldn't have been believable
on any level, you know. And Carl Weathers is still one of the baddest dudes to ever be on camera. That's one of the baddest brothers, man, to ever. I put him on camera comparable. He's the prototype for Wesley Snipes. He's a prototype before Will Smith. He's the, you know what I'm saying? Like,
you know what I
Carl
love
too, Weathers.
Is about, just for a minute on that, is it's like now, like you were saying, nowadays everything's on Instagram, this and that, and the TMZ and that.
Yeah.
And so you know everything.
Yeah.
But I've talked about this with people. It's like, And Denzel, to me, is one of the best examples. I mean, you can say to people, what do you really know about him? Like, go ahead. What do you really know about that guy? His real life. Do you really know much?
No, Denzel remains private.
How good is that, though?
Yeah.
That is so funny.
But the thing
that's a lost art.
But the thing about him, though, too, is that he's not trying to be all up in the video, like... I was going to quote Suge Knight, you know, all in the videos, dancing, come to death row, you know.
But you know what I'm saying? What do you know about Carl Weathers? You see what I mean? There's a beauty in that, though.
Yeah.
That what you know is really just all you saw.
Right. Unlike a Will Smith where, you know, he's got the red table, you see his wife Jada on everything.
I knew way too much about this guy. And I'm disappointed. That's all I'm going to say.
Yeah, yeah. Will Smith, he's like a caricature.
Kick that bitch to the curb.
You know what's funny, though? Wait, before you go there. I gotta say this. This is funny. I don't know if it's funny, but... In a moment in that book, he says, after Parents Just Don't Understand, cratered. This is before The Fresh Prince. He had to leave Philadelphia. He's living in L.A., and he's on borrowed money because he has no money. And the girl he's hanging with, I don't even think they're boyfriend or girlfriend, but they're hanging out, and she's like helping him get his head together. And then one day she just wakes up and goes, you gotta get out, you gotta do something. And he's like, what do you mean? You have to do something, you can't sit here anymore. And he's like, well, what do you want me to do? And she came up with a suggestion: go to the Arsenio Hall show and hang out, he's your friend, right? He's like you don't understand, these people are not my friends. Well, he likes you, go out, just hang out. So you want me to hang out so that maybe I might meet somebody? And she was like, yeah. Now here's the value in that. It's like, and here's the line that's hard for me to cross sometimes, because I might be diplomatic, but I'm not a politician. Like, I don't like to always have to be in people's faces. Hey, I'm doing shit. Oh, hey, you know, like, I'm like promoting myself in town, like I'm showing up at all the events, shiny, trying to get put on. Like I can't do that. I don't dislike networking. Networking is valuable. It's a valuable tool for progress. And everybody has to find their way, however they, you know. And so that's what New York was like. New York, LA in the 90s was like, you meet somebody, and as they're shaking your hand, they're looking you up and down from head to toe. They're trying to see how you put together, right? And often it'd be like, okay, yeah, you have a look. People would say this to me. Oh yeah,
you got a look.
You got a look. Yeah, you got a look. Well, what do you do? Who are you playing with? That was always those are the questions. Those are the statements. You got to look. What do you do? Oh, who do you work with? And then the next question, if they were a musician, especially if they were a drummer, how'd you get the gig? like how'd you get the gig? Why am I not on the gig, right?
What did you do? What was the magic?
L.A. Okay, so I don't know what L.A. is like now.
I hung out with Arsenio Hall. I just hung around. That's how I...
Okay, exactly. So to that effect, he did do that. And that's where he met Benny Medina. But you know what else is funny? I played Arsenio Hall with Sheena Easton during this time, unbeknownst to me. And Will Smith is in the back. And I meet him. I'm like, yo. He's like, hey, man. I don't know him, but he's nice, right? He's just being, hey. I was like, are you one of the guests tonight? No. he says, no. Oh, okay. I just looked at him like.
You didn't want to go, like, why are you here?
Yeah. I was like.
Okay.
Oh, okay. Maybe he's just...
Okay.
Yeah, I didn't say...
It ends, yeah.
It just ended. Yeah. And so that same...
Do you remember that face?
That same... Yeah, I did. Because he looked to the side. Like, what am I doing here? Why the
why am I here? I'm here. I don't know why I'm here yet. That night, Steven Seagal was on.
Oh, there you go.
That's a whole nother thing.
Now there's a guy.
Right, there's a guy, definitely. So, wow. So Seagal was the guest. And Sheena was a musical guest, Sheena Easton. So we did that. And, but Will mentions this time period in his book. It's like, yeah. And he was just hanging out, trying to meet people, trying to figure out what his new direction was. So every now and again, we do have to put ourselves, old folks used to call us, you got to set the table. You know, so sometimes you do have to get out and you got to network a little bit, you know, and do that thing. And to the other degree, you know, that's the whole squeaky wheel gets the oil mentality behind it. You know, it's like, but people don't want to see you too thirsty. You know what I mean? New York was good in that you show up to a spot and somebody introduced you to somebody, one of the cast in the band, and they go, oh, okay. Where you play? He says, oh, okay, yeah, where you from? Oh, okay, cool. You want to play? So it didn't go like, well, who have you worked with? None of that mattered. Some of the cats, because then you find some of the cats with the greatest gigs can't really hang musically. This is facts, you know. And so it doesn't matter. You can't hide behind the fact that my band just played on, you know, this thing or that thing, or we just did this, or we just flew here and there. Like, can you sit down and hold a pocket?
Right now, Quincy Jones style.
Yeah.
Here and now.
Yeah. And so that's what New York was. And it was like, oh, yeah, nice. I like that, you know. And it's intimidating, you know, because it'd be some choppers up there, some serious choppers. And then they just come hand you the sticks.
Right.
You're like, all right. You know, there's a couple times I didn't do it. And a couple times I did, and it worked out great. You know, it's triumphant.
You mean with the times you didn't, was it intimidation?
Yeah, I guess so.
I mean, it's okay to admit it.
No, truthfully, because it was like a lot of hero energy in the room. And so I was like, wow, you know, if I did play, that's a direct link to some of the things that I would like to be doing. But if I second guess it, that's a direct link to some of the things that I would like to be doing that I'll probably never do, you know? So you have to sort of know what the fuck you're made of, you know? And at certain points, you can question things, and I feel like always go for the gusto. I didn't that night. But if I could tell myself now, let's do it. Like to go back to that guy, the guy that I was at that point, nah, just do it. What you got to lose? Really? Because at the end of the day, that guy puts his shoes on just like you. That guy has got to eat as many times a day as you do. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's like, it's not that big a deal. It's really not.
Yeah, but that's, you know, youth is wasted on the young, right?
Yeah, it's really not that big a deal, you know. But you live and you learn. And like I said, maybe in this interview I've spoken about the two points in my history that maybe I question the turns that I make at that time. I don't question it now, but like after it happened, it's like, oh wow, man, I should have maybe done that. I should have zigged when I zagged. Mm. You know. But ultimately, the older I get, again, what I also said in this interview is that I'm always where I'm supposed to be. You know, so it just is what it is. There are a lot of people that did zig, and they're not in any better position than I am. You know what I mean? So, and they could have done all of the right schmoozing, all of the right all the right parties. This is before Instagram and all that stuff.
Right.
To all to the right.
Do you all that, by the way?
I do. Yeah.
Okay.
I'm on Instagram and I'm on Facebook. I don't think I've TikToked.
Uh-huh.
I had an account, and I posted something when TikTok first came out, and I didn't know how it worked. So I was like, okay.
Gotcha.
And so then my son did a TikTok the other day, and he's got like 1 million views. I was like, whoa. Like, wow, okay. He kept showing me screenshots. Dad, look, you know. Like, wow, okay, that's pretty dope. You know. So yeah, this is like a different tool, you know, that sort of the virtual lane takes the place of, you know, showing up. You know, it's like comedians have this thing now where the guys who are in their 50s, who are the comedians that are kind of out doing this thing, like the Chappelle age, maybe not at the same level as Chappelle, but the age grouping, you know, and they're looking at the 20-year-olds, like the 40-year-olds are looking at the 20-year-olds and going, okay, so these guys did a TikTok and they have like all these followers, but they can't do a 30 minutes of stand-up. And so in the comedy realm, the stand-up is king. You know, like in the jazz world, improvising, showing up now, still is king. It doesn't matter. I talked to Tommy Campbell one time, master drummer, Tommy. Played with Dizzy Gillespie, all these cats, right? And I was picking his brain one time. I was like, so man, this is before I moved to New York. I was like, I want to come to New York. Okay, what about sitting in on different people's kits? He's like, yeah, don't think about it. Just make the music. He's like, yeah, but what about the cymbal is here? And it's a bass drum. So again, this is like my 20-year-old self, you know? I was like about... See, when I met Tommy, I was about 20. Literally, I was about 20 years old. And he's like, bro, just play. Just don't worry about it. So we shared it together and stuff, man. It was amazing. Me, him, and Marvin Smitty Smith. It was beautiful. I was like, wow. And they were generous to me. They were like, wow, man, nice brushes. What is that? Like, asking me what my shit is. I'm like, and so again, for a 20-year-old, 21-year-old kid, it was beautiful, you know? And, again, I don't think I was doing anything. Even now, my language is a language that came from, again, the Art Blakey's, Max Roach, and I've understood how to speak the language in my own tongue, with my own take and my own time.
Yeah,
you know.
But that's not easy to do. Not many guys are.
Yeah. It's hard to... Sometimes it's hard to see your strength when you're still walking the path.
That's what I'm saying.
Your influence when you're still walking the path. I mean, I look around, if you want to keep it Austin or whatever, I can see my influence, you know. But then I can also leave Austin and see drummers that are 10 years younger, 20 years younger, 30 years younger than me, and see that there was a point that they all took a turn, and it's like Berkeley in the early 2000s fucked up a lot of shit, because that's where all of a sudden everybody started speaking the same language to me, on the drums in particular. And I'm not blaming Gospel Chops, but it was a combination of those two identities. They sort of made everybody in the world, even not just in America, but in the world, think that's the pinnacle.
this is what Blazing Chops means.
Yeah, so it's like, I'll see guys now do drum solos, and it's like, okay, that's everything they practice at the crib, but weren't we just playing a ballad? It's like, isn't this a ballad you guys are playing? And it's like, what the fuck just happened? You know, it's a medium tempo bop, you know, bop joint. Or, you know, everybody's trying to sound like this guy. Like all the monkeys on this island are playing like all the monkeys on that island. And so, like, this is the point I was going to make with my dad.
Yeah.
Is when he came from New York, ball players played that way there. It was universal there. But when he went came to Texas, nobody was playing it. People played that way. They played the Texas way. You know? And the same thing with jazz. It's like Kansas City didn't sound like New Orleans. Didn't sound like New York. Didn't sound like Chicago. Didn't sound like LA. All of it sounded like you knew where the cat was from. Nowadays, you don't really know where the cat's from. Unless you're sometimes I can tell where cats are from Dallas. If I don't know them, I just see them play. And then sometimes I can tell for cats from Memphis.
Okay, what is it about Dallas?
Church scene. So I know a lot of key players from my generation who are and younger.
You're saying it's a sound.
I'm saying there's a.
You can tell.
There's an aesthetic.
An aesthetic.
There's a sound. There's a sound aesthetic that they're going for. So it becomes less Jeff Watts, less Brian Blade, Greg Hutchison, you know, and it just goes down. Then it sounds more like Chris Dave, you know. And Chris playing with Kenny Garrett was beautiful. It's phenomenal, phenomenal, you know. But that's the pivot. So that and everything after that. So, but Chris is closer to my age. He's younger than me, but so Tane was, you see what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah,
so
yeah, yeah. No, it's a big leap.
Yeah.
It's a big leap. From Tane to Daddy Dave, yeah.
Yeah, so to hear Chris play, again, Chris, you know, these guys are great. But
and then what's the Memphis thing?
I don't really know jazz in Memphis as much as I do church R&B. And I can hear it.
Is it still kind of a Stax thing, or is it?
Nah, Stax is old.
So what is it? What's the new Memphis thing?
I can't explain it. I saw this singer the other day. Okay, so here's the thing. Austin in the 80s and 90s was known as the guitar place. Stevie Ray, Eric Johnson. All that kind of stuff. New Orleans, trumpet players, you know, all the way from Louis Armstrong, go all the way, you get Wenton, go a little further, Nicholas Payton, you know. It's like there's a thing, you know. Kirby Ruffins, all those guys, you know, they all kind of.
Yeah.
They,
sure.
I don't know, it's a thing.
Yeah.
Memphis is singers.
Right.
Singers. Great. And so I heard this singer, and when I was listening to the singer, I'm like, wow, it's definitely out of the church. I don't know, it's just something about I heard Miles Davis say this. Excuse me. He said that when he would listen to radio, he could always tell the black bands from the white bands. This is Miles Davis, it's not me saying this, but it's how they swung on the beat. And so because I'm a student of music, I can hear
when it's authentic. Like, there's a lot of cats now that play well. They play drums really well. Mm-hmm. Like, they play drums.
Like, you mean polite?
Huh?
Like, polite? Like, they're very...
No.
Like someone who's well-spoken?
No. I'm saying drumistically.
That's what I mean. That's what I mean. Like, in other words, they play well.
Meaning...
There's no edge. There's no...
No. I know what you're saying. But okay. What I'm saying is they don't understand music.
Okay.
They play drums.
Oh, I see.
So when I hear a drummer playing drums really well, then it becomes harder to tell where they're from. Because then it sounds like they're just from YouTube.
Okay.
But when a drummer can play music and they can play, and let's not misconstrue a high level with chops. Just because you can have chops doesn't mean you're playing at a high level. Not for me.
I totally agree with that.
You know?
Yes.
So, but when I hear a drummer authentically articulating their storyline, that's when I can hear where they're from. I'm gathering intel as the minutes go by. Who their influences were, how they navigate certain pieces, like what that says about their ego, how they're maneuvering, how they're helping other musicians on the bandstand, what they're taking for themselves. And sometimes you'll listen and you'll hear somebody ending a phrase and the drummer just played all over the end of that phrase. It's like,
yeah,
okay, YouTube. You know what I'm saying? It's
Yeah.
So I'm listening to all these things, and for some reason, because of the study, and I'm not, I think it's normal for people to study music, you know, and sort of gather intel about where people could be from. Like Michael Bland in Minneapolis sounds like that.
Yes.
You know, he doesn't sound like a Thomas Pridgen, who's the age difference. I mean, Mike is a little older than me, a couple years older.
Yeah, he's got it. Yeah.
I mean, by a year.
Oh, okay. I thought he was even older. All right.
No, I mean, I'm 51, so he's about a year.
Damn, I didn't realize he was that young when he started with all that.
I think he was 19 when he started with Prince.
Shit.
Yeah. Oof. So, but Bland, for instance, he still sounds Minneapolis to me. He's of the age where you sound like you sound. You don't sound like everybody else sounds. You know, Ron Bruner is a buddy, you know, is a guy I know. He's phenomenal, you know. I always tease him, man. Don't get the big head now, you know.
The Floyd Mayweather of the drum world.
Right, you know, but... but, you know...
I didn't coin that, by the way.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean...
Another guy.
Yeah. That's,
I stole that line.
Yeah, Bruno's great. I love him dearly, man. But, like, he... he's definitely going for something, but it's also very natural as to his story. You know what I'm saying? And so, but that playing, the style of playing, has a lot of influence. So a lot of people want to do that. They want to be that. They want to embody this, to think that they too can be at a high level. And again, not knocking him, but I'm just saying, in general, my general comment is that that type of drumming doesn't make you a high level musician. Like, I ended up being hospitalized once for something like a had a bacterial infection. Fucked up, really bad. And amputation was in the dialogue, right? And so it came back on me. So the second year when it came back, I had to go back to the hospital. It was in ICU for a week. And I was supposed to go out to do some gigs with some buddies. And I really wanted to do that gig. And I made a joke because the keyboard player was like, shit, man, who can we get? And I said, call this guy. And it was sort of a joke because he's one of these Berkeley gospel chop kids, you know. And I knew that they knew each other. And he's like, okay, let me call you back. So he calls him. Turns out the kid's available, right? So he calls me back and say, man, guess what? He could do it.
You just got replaced by your favorite,
right? And I like this guy.
I get it though.
I like this guy,
it's
right?
It's about more than that.
Okay, so and here's the thing, I'm laying up in the hospital, and every night my phone's ringing after the gig because it was like a 4-night engagement. My phone's ringing, and they're like, man, you sure you? and I'm like, well, why? My question was why?
Because all he's doing is...
They were like, okay, so for the first song, he's playing everything. Playing his ass off.
Shoots his load, and then we see everything.
He's out playing his ass off. And it they say it. Those no uncertain terms. Playing his ass off. I don't think he had any sort of other tools in the stick bag. Like, there was no, like, if they went to a ballad, he didn't have brushes. If they wanted to play a shuffle, like a blues, couldn't really hang there. And then there was a singer on the gig. So the singer was like,
give me something to lay down in.
Yeah. So again, what's mastery?
Well, this is a great topic actually for, I think drummers do need to hear more about this, because I mean I've been having this discussion, I mean not even just with jazz, we can for a moment even go outside of jazz.
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
Talk about like, yeah, and I've been saying, okay, I want to put it in this way because I think it's helpful for drummers. I've played with bass guys and all they did was fucking hold it down. And then I was like, fucking love you. Tell me your name again.
Yeah.
Like you.
Yeah.
You just held it down.
Yeah.
Who are you?
Yeah.
How did you know to do this? And I think other drummers can hear that and they can appreciate and respect that. And it's like, why is that so lost on drummers? Why not apply that?
Because YouTube and Instagram came up with the 15 seconds of fame. You know, you remember when Instagram, you can only do a 15-second video? So that was cats were doing 15 seconds of they bad as shit.
That's it. I mean, would you be more impressed, and there's another question, that thing where you go, maybe you're not even, I don't know what I'm saying, you're at a live gig, and if the drummer didn't play one fucking fill, wouldn't that catch your attention?
Yeah. I've been on situations before where, you know, I didn't see fit to hit a cymbal. You know? And, you know, try it. I've even done gigs before where I didn't take cymbals.
Yeah.
You know, and I just wanted to, it was an exercise. The first two times it happened, I started.
Did you have hats or?
What hats?
Hats and ride, or just not even ride?
No ride.
Okay.
So it was like, the first concept of that was to, I did it with no toms, so just kick snare, hat, ride, right? That's pretty common. You know, I've seen people do that before, but I hadn't seen it done around me. So I was just like, you know what? I just need to go back to the basics. This was the time of the double bass drum pedal, you know. So my I was about to be married, so at that point, and I just came from a cruise with Stephen Bruton or whatever. We came back, and I left my pedal in my suitcase. So I get to the gig, and I'm like, oh man, I don't have my gear. Call home, hey, can you bring the pedal? So she brings just the piece with the two, and it doesn't have the slave drive on the left right. pedal, the right. left leg.
Right.
So it's just a single pedal with two beaters, right. like wiggling. I was like, where's the rest of it? She's like, what are you talking about?
What are you talking about? Exactly. Yeah.
And so it was the most liberating. I never went back to the double pedal. This was like 1998. So I never went back, right? I played a double pedal once with Eric Johnson, 2000, whenever that was, 2015. We did that little run. I brought it out for that. That was the first time.
Because he wanted it?
No. I just wanted to. Oh. I hadn't played it in so long.
You wanted to just throw some triplets in?
Yeah. It was like, well, see what I can do with the old feet. Because at that point, double bass drumming had changed drastically. In that amount of time, so I'm nowhere near what guys can do with their feet now.
Yeah,
you know,
I mean that's a whole other thing.
Yeah, that's a whole. Yeah. It's crazy, you know. So I definitely wasn't going to be doing any of that, right? So I brought it out, but anyway, so I did the no time thing, the single pedal, and then I had a gig once outdoor, and the cymbals were just like parasails; they were just flying over in the wind. You don't want your cymbal to just fall and land like edge first on concrete over the stage. So I just took all the cymbals down, and I didn't realize how liberated I would feel, because I'm a cymbal guy. I'm a cymbal guy. I love cymbals. I love them. But to be without them, it just immediately reminded me of Miles Davis, you know, Keith Jarrett asking Miles questions, and Miles telling Keith when he was in the band, because it was the electric band with Ndugu playing drums, and who's gone, Mtume, who just passed away, rest in peace, Mtume, a couple days ago, master musician. Keith didn't, he couldn't, he hated the band. And so he was trying to convince Miles to somehow change up the music for his selfish reasons. Like, you're in a dude's band and the band leader's playing this music and you're asking him to play the old stuff. So he tells Keith, he said, Keith, you know why I don't play ballads anymore? He's like, no, Miles, I don't know why. Because I love ballads. So this, for someone to be so in touch with what they love that they cannot, in order for them to grow, they have to let go.
Set it free. Yeah.
And so when that moment happened, I mean, again, not equating my experience to Miles or myself to Miles, but what I'm saying is, when I took the cymbals down, how much I love them and I had no access to them, I felt free. And so it happened again, another windy gig a couple years later. This happened like a couple months ago. I can show you a picture. And it's just hats, two toms, kick snare. No cymbals. And man, it was just like, wow, what a vibe. And you don't understand that cymbals create release. Tension and release is what drumming is, basically, right? Good music. And so I had to find a way to create release without a crash or without breaking up the time with the ride. So conceptually, it brought in a whole new way to consider my role, you know. There's no splashing or why you can do certain things in the hats or whatever, but it's not like even one cymbal can can facilitate many options. One extra symbol. Without it, it's like, wow, where do you stand? You know. But sometimes, you know, accidents are happy. Happy little incidents, you know.
Those are the best.
Yeah. That's it, man. I mean, ultimately, you know, this is all just a journey. You know, it's not a destination point. I don't have going back to what's next. We will see. You know, it's like Richard Pryor. You know, it's like in his one of those comedy routines, he says that he's gonna hear a selection from the choir. They gonna sing a song called "We Will See." If you're singing by yourself, as I will see, you know, whatever. We will see. We will see. We will see. We will see. You know, it's just stupid. But you know, things like this, they resonate with me. That's why, you know, my heroes are, you know, Muhammad Ali and Bruce Lee and Richard Pryor and, you know, well, cats like that.
These are iconoclasts and mavericks and guys who just blaze their own trail and do their own thing. So I get it, man. That's what I was saying before. Like, you're clearly a thinker and a philosopher and I like that, man.
I'm just trying to connect the dots, man.
I know, that's what I'm saying. I get it. It's about the journey for you, and I like that.
Yeah.
Be water, my friend.
Exactly. You know, I was trying not to say that. Exactly. I'm glad you did.
Yeah.
Because that's something that came to mind more than once in this communication with you.
Yeah.
You know, and it's the hardest thing to be because, you know, you can experience great highs and really great lows as well. You know, because if you're not always focused on, I mean, if you don't always have things mapped out for you, it's hard to know where to focus. You know, and so when you're always kind of self-made, it's pros and cons to that.
Yeah,
a lot of pros, a lot of cons. You know, so you just have to let it be.
On that note, Brandon Temple, thank you.
Brother, thank you.